Service. You're listening to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service.
Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for October 2013. This is issue number 345. I'm your host, Fred Bobe. The address for the DX Audio Service is 706 McKenzie Drive, Lima, Ohio, 45805. Email for general inquiries is fvobe, that's F-V-O-B-B-E, at realoldiesradio.com. For subscription information and payment information, please send to sales, S-A-L-E-S, at nrcdxas.org. A yearly subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S.-Canadian members is now $30, and the magazine is published on CDs. To subscribe or renew, make your check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that I just mentioned, or you can log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using PayPal. And if you're on the Internet, you can sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with PayPal. Subscribe only if you're able to download and navigate a website without anyone else's assistance. Just a reminder that we still have the auction for the Persus Direct Sampling Software Defined Radio, that's an SDR receiver, offering continuous coverage from 10 kilohertz all the way up to 30 megahertz. The radio is in like-new condition and comes complete with a USB cord, AC adapter, SO239 to BNC, RF adapter, software, CD, and manual. More information on this receiver can be found at various websites, including the Microtelcom, that's microtelecom.it/Persus, P-E-R-S-E-U-S. The item goes to the highest bidder, and in the event of a tie, the winner will be determined by a drawing. Pre-shipping weight is 1 pound and 12 ounces. Starting bid is $950. You can send your bid and contact information to the National Radio Club, Post Office Box 473-251, Aurora, Colorado, 80047-3251. Shipping is restricted to U.S. only. Bids must be accepted only by USPS mail and must be received by November 1st, 2013. All proceeds from this auction will go to the National Radio Club, a nonprofit organization for medium wave DXers. Now here's Dave Alpert, and he's got a look at the AM switch. Dave?
This is the AM switch.
Welcome to the October issue of the AM switch, volume 80, number 30, starting with call letter changes. 980 KBBO, Sella, Washington, changes to KTCR. But KBBO won't be gone for too long. 1200 WINK, Pine Island Center, Florida, changes to WJUA, WAN 1200. I'll make a prediction that the WINK call sign doesn't stay gone for too long. 1340 WALH, Mountain City, Georgia, the silent station has changed its call sign to WELG. So that may mark the return for 1340 in Mountain City. 1370 WHYP, Cory, Pennsylvania, has decided to change back to a call sign they had 3 years ago, WWCB. And 1390 KTCR in Yakima, Washington, takes the call from 980 in Sella, KBBO. New stations moving towards getting on the air. We have one to report, 1240 KRJW, Altamont, Oregon. Applies for license to cover for new station U1, 1,000 watts day and night. New construction permits granted. We have one as well. 1020 in Blue Diamond, Nevada. This new station will be U4, 5 kilowatts day, 250 watts night. Blue Diamond is to the southwest of Las Vegas, near the Blue Diamond State Park, on Pahrump Road, about 30 miles from Art Bell's place. Not surprising, the signal shoots northeast toward Las Vegas and protects Los Angeles to the west and Roswell, New Mexico to the southeast. Construction permits expired or canceled. 1250 KACE, Mesquite, Nevada. The CP for this new station has expired and is now deleted. The CP for 1450 in Flora Vista, New Mexico has expired and is deleted. and 1490 WSCE Lamont, Pennsylvania's construction permit for a new station has been canceled at permittee's request. Applications dismissed. One from the islands, the application for 1230 in Milani Town, Hawaii, has been dismissed. Construction permits built, which means stations moving towards final licensing. 740 WDGY Hudson, Wisconsin, granted program test authority for D3, 5 kilowatts. 1370 KRAC Quincy, California, applies for license to cover for U4, 4,000 watts day, 200 watts night, moving their city of license to Red Bluff, California. 1480 KTHS Berryville, Arkansas, applies for license to cover CP to change their city of license to Green Forest, Arkansas. And finally, yet another change for 1530 WLWB New Holstein, Wisconsin, as they apply for license to cover and go D1 with 350 watts from a new site. New construction permits granted. 600 WKYH Paintsville, Kentucky, granted a CP for U1, 4,500 watts day, 40 watts at night. 660 WORL, Altamont Springs, Florida, granted U4, 3,500 watts day and a kilowatt at night. 1160 WIWA, St. Cloud, Florida, granted U4, 14,000 watts day, 500 watts at night. 1460 WEEN, Lafayette, Tennessee, granted a CP for U1, 1,100 watts day, 119 watts night. And 1510 KLLB, West Jordan, Utah, granted U1, 10 kilowatts day, 26 watts night. Applications for new construction permits, 970 KNWZ, Coachella, California, applies for U4, 5,000 watts day, 430 watts night. 1170 WDEK, Lexington, South Carolina, applies for D1, 10,000 watts day with critical hours power of 3,400 watts. 1470 WBCR, Alcoa, Tennessee, applies for U1, 1,000 watts day, 77 at night. And 1530 KQSP, Shakopee, Minnesota, applies for D4, 24,000 watts day, 17,000 watts critical hours, and 10 watts at night from a new site diplexed with WLOL 1330 system. The three-tower pattern goes north right into Minneapolis. Construction permits expiring. 820 KWDP, Waldport, Oregon. The CP for U1, 5,000 watts day and 15 watts at night, expired unbuilt, so KWDP remains. U1, 1,000 watts day, 15 at night. Applications for construction permits dismissed. 590 WAFC, Clewiston, Florida. The WAFC application for U4, 5,000 watts day and night, with a city of license change to Cape Coral, has been dismissed. WAFC will remain in Clewiston with U1, 930 watts day and 470 watts night. Stations leaving and not leaving the air. 1020 WSBX, Ochlockne, Georgia. The FCC believes the station has been silent since February 25, 2012, and wants evidence to the contrary. Otherwise, the license will be canceled. We would also be curious if they've been on, so if you know, drop us a comment on the Musings line at 419-741-0205 anytime. 1440 KELG Manor, Texas, after their license was canceled, KELG filed a late application to renew its license and an application for an STA to resume broadcasting. In their filing, they claim the station owner has been very ill and no one remembered to file the license renewal. 1450 WCOX, Camden, Alabama. The license was canceled and then uncanceled, and now license renewal has been granted, so this one is fully back among the living. 1540 WBRY, Woodbury, Tennessee. Their license was canceled in August 2012, and now WBRY applies for STA to resume broadcasting while the FCC continues to consider license renewal. And if you remember the saga of KELG Manor, Texas, just mentioned, the same issue goes for co-owned 1560 KTXZ West Lake Hills, Texas, and 1600 KOKE Pflugerville, Texas. Highlights from the Special Temporary Authority Department. 570 WMCA New York City has been operating with an STA U1 1250 watts day and night and has almost finished rebuilding after Hurricane Sandy. They've now been granted a new STA to operate licensed U3 5000 watts day and night before pattern proofs are complete. If you drive past the WMCA site on the New Jersey Turnpike in Kearney, you'll see the three self-supporting towers blinking in the swamp below the elevated turnpike structure. Low dial position and the ground in the water gives them almost as good a coverage as 50,000 watt WABC and WCBS. 730 WWTK Lake Placid, Florida is granted an STA to operate with pattern at variance during antenna system work. 820 WNYC New York is operating with STA for U1, 2,500 watts day and 250 watts night, and has almost finished rebuilding after Hurricane Sandy. They've been granted new STA to operate licensed U4, 10 kilowatts day, 1 kilowatt night, before pattern proofs are complete. 860 KKAT, Salt Lake City, Utah, granted an STA for U1, 200 watts day and night, on a temporary transmitter because their day transmitter burned up. They're known as Utah's Big Talker. Maybe we should change that to Utah's Hot Talker. 1260 WGVM Greenville, Mississippi, granted an STA for U1, 1,000 watts day, 32 watts night because their main transmitter died. 1380 WBTK Richmond, Virginia, has been granted an STA for U1, 2,900 watts day and 1,250 watts night because they lost a tower in a severe storm. 1410 WIHM Taylorville, Illinois, granted an STA for U1, 500 watts day, 63 watts night to operate at lower power so their transmitter won't overheat following failure of air conditioning system at transmitter site. 1480 WEEO Shippensburg, Pennsylvania has been granted STA for U1, 406 watts day, 9 watts night from a temporary mast. We're not sure if they lost a tower or lost the lease to the transmitter site. Anyone know? And in the X-band, 1680 WPRR Ada, Michigan granted an STA for U1, 680 watts day and night due to transmitter problems. Applications to extend existing STAs were received from and granted to WQNO 690, New Orleans, Louisiana, as they're operating U1 2,500 watts day, 1,250 night from a temporary antenna, and KNTH 1070, Houston, Texas, also still on an STA due to pattern out of tolerance. These formerly silent stations are back on the air. 1300 WBOW Terre Haute, Indiana, returned August 28th. 1400 WLYY Copper Hill, Tennessee, came back on August 30th. 1430 KWAP Wasilla, Alaska, returned on August 7th. 1550 WAZX Smyrna, Georgia, returned to the air on September 2nd. And 1580 WPJK Orangeburg, South Carolina, back with us as of August 1st. Newly silent stations, 730 WUMP Madison, Alabama, off due to transmitter failure as of August 25th. 910 KWDZ Salt Lake City, Utah, has been silent since August 17th, pending the sale of this Radio Disney station. 1310 KBOK Malvern, Arkansas, silent since August 15th, pending completion of sale and relocation of studios and offices. Formerly silent stations back on the air and now silent again. 1060 WQOM, Natick, Massachusetts, back on the air even though listed as silent in the FCC database. 1300 WKXM, Winfield, Alabama, this silent station was off since August 1st of 2012. then returned to the air June 24th of this year, but fell silent again on June 27th due to transmitter difficulties. 1480 WTKD Mobile, Alabama was silent December 12, 2012, but returned to the air August 16th, then went off again on the 19th with continued financial problems. Canadian news via Dan Siss, Sean Axelrod, as well as the WRTH 580 KFRA Ottawa, Ontario CP for U4, 50 kilowatts day, 3,000 watts at night, is now on the air. 860 CBXW Edgewood, British Columbia's LPRT transmitter, destroyed by fire in April, will not be replaced, so 860 CBXW is now deleted. CBRJ, an LPRT located in Grand Forks, British Columbia, applies to move to 107.3 FM, and once the FM is on, the death warrant for the AM is signed, and it will be going silent. Ditto 990 CBAF20, Kedgewick, New Brunswick, on their move to 98.1. An interesting item for 1040 CJMS, St. Constant, Quebec. Their license has been summoned to a CRTC hearing on November 5th to discuss ongoing issues of noncompliance. Unlike the FCC, the CRTC takes noncompliance with regulations quite seriously and has revoked a couple of station licenses in recent years, such as the old CJRN on 710 in Niagara Falls, Ontario. And 1570, CKMW Winkler, Manitoba, is silent and now deleted. They've moved to 88.9 FM. Our thanks to Sean Axelrod, Bill Hale, Frank Welch, Terry Kruger, and Glenn Hauser for information and corrections to this column. Remember, if you hear something you think we should know, call us on the Musings line or send us an email or a note to Fred. I'm Dave Alpert in Los Angeles. Let's switch it over to Mark Durenberger in Minneapolis for a look at the band scan.
Well, thank you, Dave. This month, we step back to Friday night, August 2nd, 2013, and the 2013 Joint DX Convention, a chat session on the future of DX clubs. This program was moderated by Skip Dabelstein and includes a lot of feedback from many of you concerning where the clubs are going.
When Mark told me that for sure we were going to have a joint effort with the four clubs, I thought this would give us a unique opportunity to get a variety of opinions and views on issues that probably affect all of us in some cases the same way and in different ways. And I think some of the things that we're experiencing are being experienced by radio clubs all around the country, whether they're broadcast band DX clubs, shortwave clubs, or those types of things. I happen to be a member of two amateur radio clubs in Tucson. One is the Southern Arizona DX Association, 73 members, and the other is the Radio Society of Tucson with over 100 members. And about a year ago, we started looking at what is the future of the club, because it occurred to us that we don't have a single member under 50 years old. And what would you guess, based upon a recent survey, the average age of the members of the National Radio Club is? 61 years old. So what I've got tonight basically is to talk about what I've seen in the way the club has changed and the things that attracted me to get in the hobby when I got in 1959. Some of the changes are positive. A lot more, I think, are negative from the standpoint of making the hobby more challenging. And then I'd like to move that into a two-part discussion and kind of get the thoughts of everybody. I don't know that we'll come up with any solutions tonight, but I think we probably come up with some ideas of what are the issues that most, if not all, of the clubs are facing. So on the top of the handout is I'm kind of starting off by identifying some of the changes that I've seen in the hobby occurring over the years that really, insofar as what interests me in getting into the hobby in 1959, aren't there today. And we'll also talk about some of the positives. But first of all, we have band conditions. When I got into the hobby, all daytime-only stations were allowed to sign on with full power and full daytime facilities at 4 a.m. local time. In most months, well before sunrise, I could sit out in Omaha, Nebraska, and I could hear every morning of the year, Red Lion, Pennsylvania on 1440, Roaring Springs, Pennsylvania on 1370, Warrington, Virginia on 1420, signing on at 3 o'clock my time. As we got into to the late 60s, the FCC changed the rules and came up with this pre-sunrise authority that pretty well limited the stations signing on at 6 a.m. or later, given what the local average sunset sunrise time for the month was. And if the 6 o'clock sign-on was before sunrise, then they had to do it at reduced power. So that eliminated a huge potential population of stations that we could hear. Also, back in those days, most full-time stations signed off at midnight, and those that didn't, most of those went off the air one day a week, mostly on Monday mornings. We also had stations on the graveyard channels limited to 250 watts, so you could really DX those stations. And if you look at the attachments to the handout, I've got a couple of things to kind of put into perspective the way the hobby was in the early 60s relative to what we're seeing today. The first attachment is a 1962 National Radio Club frequency checklist. Stations were very concerned about their operating quality, their operating characteristics, the maintaining their frequencies. And so they would come on the air generally once a month in early morning hours, broadcast a test tone, and have frequency checks. And you can look at here and see how many different stations back in those days conducted monthly frequency checks. I verified hundreds of stations back then that were conducting frequency checks. We also have, if you go past the frequency checklist, I've got just a sample from 1963, what the DX test calendar looked like. And a lot of times, we had three or four or even five DX tests scheduled for a single Monday morning. And behind that, I've got a copy of the 1964 condition of frequencies list. And look at those frequencies. How many of those frequencies, at least one day a week, had nobody on from midnight to local sunrise? And even the graveyarders, there's some graveyarders on here that only had six stations nationwide. So when you had those kind of conditions, those kind of band conditions, you could really catch some good stuff. I remember in the early 60s in Omaha, my pest on 1230 was Houston, Texas, KNUZ. And listening to Kaz this morning, or this afternoon, I guess, was talking a couple of his catches, 1590 in Seattle, and 1330 from Los Angeles, back where he lives in Illinois. Those are really good catches today. In the 70s, when I lived in Lincoln, Nebraska, those were regulars. 1590 from Seattle and 1330 with their classical music out of Los Angeles. So this is how conditions have changed. And so, you know, it's become more challenging. And I think we're all for a good challenge, but also I don't think A.J. Ford or Mario Andretti would have ever won the Indy 500 riding a go-kart. And today, trying to DX a broadcast band, in some instances, I feel like I'm trying to win the Indy 500 driving a go-kart. So those are some of the band condition changes that I've observed over the years that make it less appealing today than when I get into the hobby. The second part, if you'll notice, I talk about radio station operations and personnel. Back in those days, there was much more live programming at night. You could actually hear station IDs about every 5 minutes or local commercials that would help you identify where the station was. Now, if you're not there at the top of the hour, you're not going to hear that ID. And what I've discovered, that occurs about 2 minutes after the signal fades out. Also, station personnel have a far different outlook towards DXers in these days. When I got in the club in the 60s and 70s, station personnel, particularly the chief engineers, were understanding of and sympathetic of our hobby. Most of those chief engineers, or certainly many of them, were DXers themselves. I'm reminded of, there was a guy that was chief engineer. His name was Carly Mathis at KBRX in O'Neill, Nebraska on 1350. I visited him one time, and whereas I have all my verifications in binders so I can show what I've been able to hear, he has all of his reception reports in binders so he can show people where his station has been heard around the country. And every radio station had to have a chief engineer. And if you were directional, you had to have a chief engineer on site full time. That doesn't happen anymore. Stations don't have chief engineers. If they need engineering services, they use contract engineers. But back then, when there was chief engineers, you had equipment tests, you had proofs of performance, you had frequency checks, and all of these occurred between midnight and local sunrise. It afforded a great opportunity to add to your DX log. That kind of goes into the third part, club membership and interaction. When I got into the club, the bulk of DX news in the National Radio Club was musings from the members. It was limited, I believe it was 30 lines. It was not only what people had heard, what people had verified, but there was also personal information. So even though I had never met these people, by the time I ran into them at a convention, I felt like they were an old friend. You could learn something of the personality and the philosophies of different people. Over the years, the Musings has essentially disappeared and has now become the DX Digest. And by the way, I want to mention the disclaimer. These are my views. I don't know that they're necessarily shared by everybody in this room, but I'm just kind of speaking from the perspective of one person and the things that I've seen as some of the changes in the hobby. When I got into the club, what we now call the DX Digest was a single page on the back of the bulletin. And what it contained was last-minute information. New stations signing on the air, stations doing pre-operational testing, stations maybe no longer operating all night or starting to run all night, those kinds of last-minute tidbits. Musings have pretty well gone away, and now that kind of is taking up what the bulk of the club bulletins are. Another thing is that when I got into the club, I was 13 years old in 1959. And throughout the 60s and into the 70s, I would say about 25-30% of the Musings were from members who were under 21 years of age. How many members in this room are under 30 years of age? And so we had people join at a young age, and a lot of those people continued to stay in the club. So back in those days, we had a lot of the older members that were talking about what to them was the good old days, but a lot of us young guys developing interest in the hobby and carrying the hobby on. But that isn't happening today in most radio organizations, whether it's ham radio or broadcast band DXE. And, you know, it's interesting, in ham radio, the FCC has done a lot of things to make it more attractive. They've eliminated the code test. They've allowed power to increase from 1,000 watts to 1,500 watts. They've created more bands like 12 meters and 17 meters. On the AM band, all of these changes I've been talking about decreased the things that we can accomplish on the broadcast band. And then I guess given that, as we've kind of alluded to with some of the other speakers, both the IRCA and the NRC have seen a relatively significant drop from the membership highs of a few years ago down to where they are today. So those are all of the things that I've seen in the hobby that make me question, would it have the same draw today for me as it did when I got in? What is it that makes people come into our hobby? Now, those are kind of all the negatives. I want to acknowledge that there have been some positives. Certainly, technology. The receiving equipment we have today is far greater than anything we had back in the 50s and 60s. The things like SDR radio, digital signal processing, and all of that. It's better equipment, although I still find it difficult to think a radio this big will outperform my HQ-180 that was this big or John's 390. But like I said, there have been some things that make it, in some aspects, better today than it was back in 1959. Certainly, the antenna technology, some of the developments in beverage antennas and some of the stuff that Kaz and Mark have been talking about with the antenna technology that they use, people weren't doing that. And people are able to fight the interference that exists today and so forth with that type of technology. And I think perhaps even most significant is the way information is disseminated today. We have more timely and accurate information today through such things as EDXN, the DX audio service, the AM log. So the hobby, to say the least, has changed significantly from when I first got into it 54 years ago. And so with this being a joint club convention, two national broadcast band DXing clubs, a regional multi-band club, and a national VHF club, I think we represent a pretty good cross-section of the DXing interest in the country. I would guess that most of the issues that any one club is facing is being faced by other clubs, and so I thought this would be a good opportunity. I don't know that we're going to solve anything today, but maybe we can identify the issues that clubs can kind of take a second look at themselves and say, are there things we can do to make the hobby better? Go ahead, Kaz.
Perhaps we could do something as clubs or clubs together. CC Radio advertises on some of these late night talk shows. Now, you would think that maybe if they would advertise a little more, they might, or mention some of the stuff they can hear, they might get some people interested in DX that buy these CC radios. That's an ideal place to start out DXers and to look for DXers.
Well, that's a good comment, and that leads directly into the first discussion point that I think I'd like to kind of focus our comments on, and then we'll take some questions. But number one, given all of the changes that have occurred in the broadcasting industry and on the AM radio band during the past few decades, what is the draw of the BCB DXing hobby today, and is that likely sufficient to sustain long-term interest in the hobby? So I'll open it up for comments. First one, Nick.
I guess one of the things is you could just analyze where the heck many of us came from. And I'll give one personal experience. A lot of the younger guys, when I got into the hobby, basically were looking for what they considered good music on the radio. And it wasn't local. You know, you had to go out of town for it. And, you know, essentially the world has changed. I mean, my experience is irrelevant now of looking for good music. If somebody, and I guess maybe that'll segue into something else. Essentially, I think what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is we're a bunch of old guys, we're the young members. And my take on that is two things. One is it's demographics, for starters. When you joined the hobby, there were old members. There was this huge burp of baby boomers coming along. And so even if only a certain small percentage of baby boomers were interested in the hobby, it was still way more than the older group was, because they were a bigger demographic. We're facing the opposite thing right now. So that's one strike against us. The second strike is that I think essentially we were looking for other people who thought like us. You know, like maybe we were little misfits at school or something like that. And it was really neat to find a radio club. You know, hey, these are people sort of like me. A young person today, and for the last 10 or 20 years, they've seen the same thing we have. All of a sudden, you can reach out to people just right away. You know what I mean? You don't have to have the medium of a club. You know, there's all sorts of ways of communicating with other people just like you on the other side of the world. So we're facing a big issue here. And I'll shut up there, but there's a number of other things that are, you know, that I can think of that will, they may help us in a way to address the problem, but they also point out what a big problem it is. I don't think it's just radio clubs. I think people aren't joiners the way they used to be. Part of that is because they can find true.
And I think
people like them without joining a formal organization.
And I think that's what we read. What are the changes, and what do we have to take into consideration to give people some reason to join a club? I mean, when I got in, one of the big things that I was interested in, I was never more than 500 miles from home until I got out of college.
Yeah.
But when I was 12 years old, I could turn on my radio and I could be in Cincinnati, or I could be in Los Angeles, or I could be in New York and listen to the news and the commercials.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was a way for me to vicarious travel when my family couldn't afford to send me anyplace. So everybody, that's why I said, everybody probably has a different perspective, and I'll pass this around for other comments. Yeah. But that, I think, is one of the things is there a draw in the hobby today? What would the draw today be? And what can we do to try to see that flourishes? And I think you were first. John, and then I'm going to move to the second.
I have children and grandchildren. I've got four children and six grandchildren. None of them listen to any radio, as far as I know. AM, FM, or what, they watch the idiot box, or they get it online or through iPads. I think that is one of the big problems with attracting young people. They're just not interested.
Well, take the kids that are, you know, in their 20s and teens or even the 30s, and, you know, technology, RFI in the bands is horrible today. When I moved to my house in 2001, I literally took my 2010 around with me when I was looking for houses, and I found a nice quiet house. Today, there's a racket all across the long way, medium way.
So computers, cable TV, light dimmer switches.
When he turns on his radio, all he hears is noise. And then, like, when he goes back to about programming, like, what do people want to listen to?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's one thing, like, when we do DX thing, it's like fishing. We go out to do the catch, but what are the kids now? They're tied up with television. They've got all the computer games and other nonsense they can do.
But answer my question, seriously. Why would you or wouldn't you join a DX club? What do the clubs have to offer? What should they offer?
That's becoming harder, too, because in the olden days, you would get together, talk about what you did, what you're listening to and hearing stuff. Nowadays, we have forums. NRC has them. I belong to a few other forums. So you can get somewhat real-time information exchange, too. Then also there's, you know, chat groups where you can get real time. So you can sit there live talking with people. They're all over the world saying, I can hear this, you know, I can hear this station over in Iowa right now.
I think as far as people under, let's say, 40 being interested in this, there's still some interest out there. Not the way it was, but it's in different venues. How many of you participate, say, in radioinfo.com, radiodiscussions.com? That's not very many hands in this room.
A little bit.
There's a pretty active DX forum going there. A lot of the guys in there, I think from what I know of them, are considerably younger than this group.
Yeah.
We're not in front of them. They don't see what we're doing here, and a lot of them, because that's free and this isn't, are going to go there and are not going to go here. How many of you are on the ABDX list?
Still
Again, not very many. I think the median age there is considerably younger, too.
Yeah.
again, there's no formal club structure to it. So there's a difference, I think, generationally in what people are willing to do as far as actually joining something that comes with dues and that comes with a payment and that comes with renewals as opposed to just being there in the form that they're accustomed to it. And like it or not, if we want the word to be here to survive, that's something we got to confront with.
Just by a show of hands, curiously, just getting back to the original point, how many think there's a sufficient draw today to attract people and keep people in the hobby by a show of hands? I think there are three hands in the air. Okay, that segues into my next question, and that is whether or not we have a draw, and that's yet to be resolved. Given the widespread use today of text messaging, email, Facebook, internet chat boards, and other social media, plus the beliefs by many that the AM band is going to disappear sometime in the near future, do radio clubs, national and or regional, have a continuing relevance as we go forward? Do they remain a feasible way to celebrate the hobby, regional or national radio clubs? And that is a diminishing group.
Theo Donnelly from BC in Canada, but I'm a New Zealander by birth. I was down in north of Auckland for the New Zealand Radio DX League's 65th anniversary convention back in March. Same discussion took place, and I can see the conclusion is going to be exactly the same. It's the survival of the club itself as that club gradually diminishes as the membership disappears, unfortunately.
Did you have a comment, Vincent?
Yes, I was just wondering if in order to attract young blood into clubs, if maybe we should emphasize more science and technology, the way it interacts with the hobby, because based on what we already heard, we are not going to attract young people because of the programming or the music. They have better alternatives out there. So if we could maybe turn one of the biggest problems we have nowadays, noise, if we could turn that around and try to attract young people, say, well, let's do some research on how we can mitigate noise, what can we learn, what kind of technologies is out there. And I'm not saying that we have to become an engineering club. I'm saying that we have to become more experimenters and try to bring that technology, science, and development that we can all do into the hobby. And maybe that will bring young people into the hobby, because then they have the skills with computer programming, at least in most of them nowadays will have some kind of technology inclination because of the world we live in. So I'm just wondering if that would be one possible path to pursue.
Mike or Jim, what is the number of members in EMDXC today?
We're still up around 33.
Well, 41.
How many typically show up at a monthly meeting?
Average between 8 and 12.
Okay, so roughly a third?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I said national versus regional clubs. A regional club, and I am a member of the MDXC, can get together and do face-to-face interaction on a regular basis. On the national clubs, this is it. And out of the, and granted, there are people who hold memberships in both, but probably 600 members combined in the IRCA and NRC. And how many do we have here? And this is once a year. So is there perhaps a diminishing need for this on a national level and moving towards a regional level? That's another thought. Got Wally?
I think a lot of it has to do with the person's time and whatnot. I'm in races in my community and whatnot. We have about 24, 26 members on the roster, and if there's an event or if there's a training, we're lucky to get 6 or 8. I'm supposed to be at a training event tomorrow. Well, I'm not. But, you know, that's an issue. That's a big issue, even with groups. And I will tell you right now that our demographic and our races group in Rowlett, Texas, skews a little bit younger than this, but not by much. People today have become, the younger generation in particular, have become totally conditioned to wanting it and getting it now. I have worked in television for 30 plus years in Dallas, and it cocks me off because of my age, I guess, but it makes perfect sense. You know, when we're watching the 10 o'clock news, 11 o'clock if you're on the East Coast, and they say, blah, 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 and you can go to WFAA.com and get more information on that. Mm-hmm. So this is, again, that ratification society. That's why I kind of like, for example, on radiodiscussions.com, I can look at every morning and see what, you know, maybe the 10 or 12 regular posters are there that are there, you know, post, and, you know, they've heard something, maybe they've not heard something, whatnot. That's handy to me. And I think if clubs or organizations are going to survive, they're going to have to become really information providers and being able to have unique content you can't get anywhere else. It's not like a radio station. Unique content you can't get anywhere else and provide it on time. And one comment that Vincent was making made me think of one thing. The broadcasting industry is facing the same issue with engineers. There are not going to be very many more Marks or Ron Rackleys or Jack Selmyers, who's a friend of mine. And, you know, the hobby is getting it, but the industry is also getting it. They've got questions that have to be answered.
Okay. I think if you look at it, AM broadcasting has gone back almost 100 years. The first broadcast, if we accept KDKA in November of 1920, that's almost been 100 years now. It's been a great run, but it's going to end. And back in the 1920s, everyone who was a listener was a DXer there, right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. But my grandfather told me about that. Silent Night used to be in the evenings in Chicago. The stations would go off on Monday night. And when I was most active in the 1970s, everyone was still an interesting hobby. There was a lot to hear. And now it's tough to really make a case. I mean, you can still hear distant stations, but it's really difficult to do. And I think too difficult for the average person or the younger person who probably doesn't listen to AM radio at all.
Somebody, go ahead.
Yeah, I've been concerned about this for years, and part of it is out of my own experience, even with work schedules, and my 20-year-old son isn't really interested. He thinks it's a novel idea about the shortwave. But I'll tell you, from my experience, when I want to find information, I'll go on the web, and one of my sources is the ODXA. Now, they're a bit of a distance away, but on the other hand, they give me some ideas. And what is it? I think our niche, each club has a niche, as we've defined and we've heard today. Part of it is to use that as a marketing tool so people become dependent on quickly getting whatever information we have. So if we're posting what we're hearing, so people say, well, we can go on the NRC or IRCA or whatever's website to see what's happening. Then that's going to be the new link. People aren't going to go, yes, we're all busy. We're not going to want to drive even 20, 30, 40 minutes some weeks, especially depending on our family schedules. But how else can we maintain that that connection. Some dependence connection. On what we as a club can provide? So it's a marketing deal.
Is there a question over here? Or? Yeah, okay, Andy.
Well, none of us can bring back radio the way we wish it used to be, or the way we wish it was. Radio Shack may not last from what I'm reading this week. Barnes & Noble, it's not radio, but it won't be around too many more years. I wouldn't buy any stock in it. But someone who's got more skin in the game than NRC members would be the equipment manufacturers and wholesalers. And I wonder if they, obviously it'll cost them money, but could they do a better job of getting the fun of radio out to a greater audience than hobby magazines?
So, Terry, your question.
Oh, my number of comments just keeps increasing. Right now it's up to 3. I'll try to make all of them short. There's still interest in one of the things that got many of us interested in the hobby, and that's connectivity. And kids are getting that through messaging each other and through social media. If we're going to connect our interests with theirs, in some way we ought to have a presence on social media. I don't know exactly what that is, but that would direct them to our websites. Next thing, I know that regional clubs are valuable for now, but I think Los Angeles is about a decade ahead of what unfortunately may happen to Minnesota DX Club and others. We used to have a membership in SCADS of, 40 or so. There were 150 who would come to meetings in the 70s. I would see 40 on a good day, 90 on an extraordinary day in the mid-80s, 20 in the 90s, a dozen or so at the beginning of 2000s, and a handful of people around 2007, 2008, And now it's an extraordinary thing when the club has an event at all, the way they're having a picnic next Saturday. I imagine when I go out to the park, I will see fewer than 8 people there. That's my second comment. And the third one is manufacturers are bringing this on themselves, because I've talked with Bob Crane about some ideas for various receivers, and he says the chips for what you are asking about are not being made. We cannot get them. So there you are. The interest is there. The physical parts are not there. So we have business not supporting this and manufacturing not supporting the AM band. It's no wonder that membership is falling.
And I think you referenced to SCADS, correct me, is it the Southern California Area DXers?
Southern California Area DXers, it was an all-interests radio club, and then became a website. And now it's hard to tell what it is.
I think we've got time for maybe one or two more. And go ahead, Mike Page.
You need to maintain a focus if you're going to run a regional club, but you have to have it such that you have a broad enough range of interests included so that you can keep it going. In other words, MDXC started out as a shortwave club. Mm-hmm. Shortwave broadcasting started to diminish. We had to adapt. We've got a number of ham radio operators. We've got medium wave DXers, beacon DXers, enough of a broad enough range, I think, to keep things going. But also, it depends on the leadership. If the leadership has to have a pulse on what's going on, if you lose pulse what's going on, then you've got a problem.
One more.
Go
ahead, John.
I have a little thought. I hope I'm not the last thought, but I
depends on when you finish.
Yes, okay.
Wait a minute, he might want that radio back.
My primary consideration in remaining in the National Radio Club, remaining in IRCA, joining other organizations and so forth, is the memories that I have, and the people who are part of this organization, people who go back with me for 50 plus years, and there are more of us out there, but we just don't seem to get around to national gatherings anymore. I would hate to see us old timers drop the organizations because we can't find newcomers. But I would certainly strongly support any effort to find newcomers. But I don't honestly know a way to attract a kid to join to become a part of our hobby when they listen to what is on the air, and there aren't any, as we've talked about it in the Boston area, DX, there aren't any stations between the stations anymore.
John is always one to share his wisdom. I'll have to mention that fairly early in my DXing career, John was at KPDN in Pampa, Texas. I heard one of those things referred to earlier as a frequency check. And it was John in his verification response to me that said, in addition to identifying that we were conducting a frequency check and the time of the identifications, it would be useful to say what was said during those identifications. So John has been a wealth of knowledge all of these years.
I know you said a last comment, but I think John actually brought up a really interesting point there that sort of crystallized what I've been thinking is, I think we too have to address, why are we still in the hobby? Now, John, you said why you're still in the hobby, and it's a really good reason. However, it's not a reason that's going to attract new blood.
You saw
what Kaz and I were presenting today.
Yeah, what
and
you then, guys are doing is the future of the hobby.
That's
no question.
And that's what Vincent is suggesting also.
And you all are my heroes.
Thank you
for keeping this this hobby going. You and the ones who and the ones who have published the bulletins, the ones who have kept up the NRC log, the ones who have done the work.
Yes.
And sometimes I know that it's maybe thankless, but you've got my thanks.
Now Terry had the right comment, I thought, when she said the way to attract or try to attract or appeal somewhat to some younger folks is through social media. I've got an 18-year-old at home, and she's about to go off to college, and I want to tell you, that kid and her friends are on that smartphone or that computer every waking moment, trying to connect, talk to other kids.
Right.
They're on Facebook all the time.
It's now, Facebook?
Most of us...
But not the IRCA Facebook page.
Most of us don't know... Some of us don't know what Facebook is. I'll be honest with you.
Yeah.
Okay? But how? What if we had, from cooperation of the clubs, a joint AMDXers Facebook page? Or we can cooperate with WTFDA as well. Even the shortwave club. We can have some kind of joint club that's contributed to.
Right.
You can even make it worldwide.
Yeah.
This is something for our leadership to look into. And you know something? Maybe our kids aren't going to be on these Facebook pages. But maybe some of them will, or maybe some of them will come on there because, ooh, daddy's picture's on there. And all of a sudden, and then they show their friends, you know. That's daddy in Oregon out on the coast setting up DX antennas, you know. And they say, oh, what beautiful scenery.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden, you've got 6 or 7 likes, et cetera. And maybe one of those gets interested in the hobby. And then we give them all the information.
Yeah.
So you get the kids looking. You get them interested, because in a lot of places you're not going to get them listening to AM radio for content, you know, because not everybody's fortunate enough to live where I do with 5 acres where I can have fantastic antennas and it's acceptably quiet. A lot of these kids, they live in apartment buildings, and what do you get in an apartment building but locals on AM? Noise.
You don't even get locals.
And sometimes you can't get your locals.
Yeah. Too much noise. So,
Jim, you had a comment.
Yeah, my view, actually, I got two things I want to bring up. Is setting up a Twitter account to report DX reports.
Good.
Because everybody can get on it. It can just pop up, little comments. And I think the kids are out there. I think there's kids out there listening to AM and listening to FM. Because I hear kids on ham radio all the time, and they're articulate, and they're interested, and they're into it. And I think it's just a matter of finding them, trying to find out how can we get them to come in, to join the clubs, how can we get them to be interested in coming into the meetings, you know, and joining us.
And these kids that are here are probably in reasonably quiet areas and have some land for antennas.
I know
stuff about antennas.
You're not putting
up a ham station working on any kind of shortwave or 160 or even 40 if you haven't got some space and some land.
I heard a kid on the Ole Miss net, I don't think he was a teen, he wasn't even a teenager yet. Ole Miss, 20 meters, but anyway, they needed a net operator the next day. He said, I can do it tomorrow. Okay, you can do it. Here's a 12-year-old kid operating a net.
Yep.
Ole Miss net.
And to your comment about Twitter, that kind of gets back to the original proposition. Is given all of these other social media options, does the concept of a radio club, whether it's the IRCA, the NRC, as it exists today, is it going to continue to be relevant? Is it to continue to be economically feasible? Or should the clubs start exploring what their future is?
Yes.
Should they be exploring ways to be more competitive by changing the way they operate and interact with their members? Or should they start thinking in terms that maybe we're a dying business and we need to start thinking of how we're going to phase out?
It has to go more online. Perhaps publishing a paper copy of the bulletin is a dying business.
Yeah, it definitely is a dying business in some clubs.
I myself pay five bucks extra for EDXN, and that's where I get almost all my information from that I don't get on the forums. I'm on EDXN looking at the columns the day they come out. And when the bulletin comes, I don't need the bulletin, other than an occasional article in there. But again, I could probably download the whole thing in PDF file and not even need the bulletin. That's where we got to be headed.
Wayne?
Where we're at right now is a situation that we call an amateur radio with repeater groups. We're moving into what might be a legacy organization. As long as we have a cadre of people and can financially figure out how to continue to support that cadre of people, I'm not ready to see the National Radio Club have to stop a printed magazine. Why? We have, last I looked, we've got just about 400 people who take that.
The printed
period.
Magazine.
That's all they take is the printed magazine. Okay. They want the printed magazine. I like the printed magazine. You know why? I can curl up on the couch with the printed magazine without having it in my lap at 9 o'clock at night and go through and read at my leisure stuff I may have spotted the tips in, but I can read the rest of it. We still have a large quantity of people out there who want what we are supplying.
but you still need to be thinking in terms of, because they
well,
are
and
what I'm looking at here is the reports of our demise, I think, are a little premature.
Well, my view is I don't, as I said earlier, we're not going to answer these questions tonight, but I think it's really imperative for all the clubs to kind of revisit what is the draw in the club, what is the continuing viability. For example, there are a number of people in this room who rely solely on the DX audio service. Mm-hmm. And we've heard over the past few days folks like Terry and Mike extolling the virtues of Fred Bovey and his operation. What if, God forbid, Fred was in a car accident tomorrow? Do we have a contingency plan to continue the DX audio service? And there are 50 other things like that. So if we believe that the club has a continuing relevance and a role, that the hobby will continue, perhaps in a different form, and I think we at least need to start anticipating where are we going the next 5-10 years and how do we get there.
You and have the right idea. I think you've got to get connected. What I'd like to do is ask Phil how the IRCA Facebook page
I don't know how our I don't know.
I'm not on it myself. I just know it exists.
Yeah, I know it exists.
Robert's been posting the last couple of days.
Okay.
People were posting about the convention.
That's, I think, unfortunately.
I posted Wednesday when I got in town that I was in town attending the convention. But I got to make myself do that, because that's the only way it's going to get noticed.
Well, like I said, I don't know they're going to answer any of these things. I appreciate everybody's comments. I think whether we're a regional or national club, broadcast band, multi-band, I think there's a lot of these issues that we share in common, and if we intend to have our clubs continue on over the years, I think we got to start focusing on these things sooner than later.
This is being recorded. Skip, is this, are you going to sort of write up, quote?
Yeah, probably post it. I'm going to try to post most of this. Yeah,
you know, I'm going to try and get some other ideas.
Yeah. I never had the recording too, but I'm going to send it to Fred also.
You're my backup.
Yeah.
So thank you for all your very valuable comments.
Right.
And there you have a cross-section of opinion on the value and the future usefulness of our DX clubs. This session happened Friday night during the recent 2013 joint DX convention. If you have comments about what you just heard, you can add to the dialogue by calling the Musings line. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service, back to work next month. And until then, good listening, DXers.
Ghostbusters-like crew of amateur radio operators help in emergencies. This article appeared in the Denver Post on September 13, 2013, and was written by Andy Vong. When disaster strikes and traditional telecommunication services are curtailed, who do emergency responders call? A Ghostbusters-like crew of amateur radio operators. Better known as hams, these are hobbyists who spend their days toiling as divorce attorneys, software engineers, or drone helicopter designers. During their free time, they serve as experts in old-school communications technology that rides on radio frequencies referred to as the amateur band. On Friday afternoon, about 65 volunteer ham radio operators were stationed at emergency operation centers, or EOCs, and shelters along the Front Range. Some started helping just as the Colorado floods hit Thursday, and a couple hundred hams have been rotating shifts. From Colorado Springs all the way up to Fort Collins, we've had hams involved at each EOC and the state EOC, said Jack Siacha, Colorado Section Manager for the American Radio Relay League, the National Association of Amateur Radio Operators. We've looped them all together via ham radio, and we've linked all of the shelters that we had access to via ham radio. In some cases, like in Lyons, in Jamestown, in Estes Park, ham radio has been primarily the only communications in and out for a while. Siacha, who manned the Boulder County station Friday, said there are several thousand licensed hams in Colorado. About 700 are members of the Amateur Radio Emergency Service, which provides support during floods, fires, and other disasters. We've been active, literally, since the forecast came out 2 days ago, said Robert Wareham, Section Emergency Coordinator for Colorado ARES. The state and local governments couldn't afford to have us on payroll. But when disaster strikes, they find us indispensable. More than 50 repeater systems are installed along the Front Range, atop mountain peaks and commercial towers, enabling communications among 5-watt handheld radios and other equipment. We can tie multiple repeaters together so we can cover a wide area, Wareham said. The real magic of amateur radio is we can put together things very quickly. If there are areas with insufficient coverage, Wareham said hams could get a portable repeater system up and running in as little as 30 minutes. During the High Park fire, several of our people worked with the Forest Service and assisted them in setting up their own repeaters out on various mountain peaks because we knew the area and we also know how to set up the technology equipment, he said. The Mile High chapter of the Red Cross sought assistance from ARES on Friday and lauded the group's help. We are very fortunate to have a representative from the Denver Amateur Radio Emergency Service here, volunteering his expertise and service 24/7, said Elisa DiTrolio, a volunteer spokeswoman for the Red Cross in Denver. He is monitoring traffic and shelters and staying in regular contact with the state EOC.
Thanks, Chris, and this seems like an appropriate time to go to part two of the National Radio Club's DX audio service for October 2013.
Higher, whoa, taking you higher, a little bit higher, WGRT 95 NJ.